thank you for tuning in to the Postmodern Realities Podcast from the Christian Research Institute and the Christian Research Journal. I'm Melanie Cogdill, Managing Editor of the Christian Research Journal. It's October 2020, and you're listening to episode 205, which is a conversation about the film Tenet and the other films of director Christopher Nolan. On this episode, I'm joined by Dr. Philip Tallon, who is the author of The Poetics of Evil and also The Absolute Basics of the Christian Faith. Dr. Tallon is currently the interim dean at the School of Christian Thought at Houston Baptist University. Phil has written an online exclusive film review for the Christian Research Journal, and his review is called Time May Change Me, But I Can't Change Time, Reversing Time to Understanding Christopher Nolan's Tenet. And you can read it for free online at our website, equip.org. Phil, it's good to have you on.
Oh, so glad to be back again.
Well, Christopher Nolan has had quite the impressive 20-year run of many films, many of which actually have been both box office and critical successes. Of course, the most famous of those is probably The Dark Knight trilogy, which dominated theaters and set, you know, quite a high bar for any comic book or superhero movie. And he originally gained recognition with his film Memento, and he actually got an Academy Award nomination for Best Original Screenplay, and some people might have seen his other films that are well-known, The Prestige or Inception, which received many Oscar nominations, and also Interstellar and Dunkirk, and now Tenet, which is his big film for 2020, which has been kind of interesting in its release because of COVID. So can you please tell us a little bit about the place that Christopher Nolan occupies in Hollywood filmmaking?
Yeah, Christopher Nolan is, you know, one of the dominant younger filmmakers. I say that, you know, I think he's about my age. He came up, you know, sort of at the very tail end of the 90s independent cinema boom. And in fact, his film Memento, which I regard as his best, in some ways, was the kind of the death knell of that independent cinema boom. It was incredibly clever, you know, just wonderfully made, and, you know, just had so much trouble getting distribution. And I think it sort of signaled a shift away, especially from independent cinema and back toward, you know, major Hollywood studios being kind of dominant distributors. Fortunately, Christopher Nolan was fully able to transition within that shift, and his subsequent, you know, movie Insomnia is made within the studio system. And then he stepped from there into the Batman franchise, his first, you know, installment of the Batman franchise, Batman Begins, which came out in 2005. It was sort of on the rising tide of superhero movies. So he'd had Spider-Man and X-Men that were successful, and Nolan offered this, you know, kind of a grittier take on Batman, and the film worked, though I don't think it was hailed as, you know, this amazing landmark movie. It wasn't until Christopher Nolan's The Dark Knight, which is a big, sort of sprawling epic, wonderfully made, very realistic for a comic book movie, comparatively, certainly, and it was this dominant, you know, box office phenomenon, you know, one of the highest grossing film of that year, and comic book movie, the highest grossing comic book movie of all time. And it was, you know, really quite a phenomenon. And that basically put him right on top of the pile of Hollywood filmmakers. And then he followed up that movie with Inception, which was his own story, basically an original story that he had written together with his brother, I believe. And and that movie was also just, you know, incredibly well received and very successful, sort of twisty mind bender. And so with those two movies, Nolan really established himself as, you know, one of the most significant original storytellers, but also someone who can handle an intellectual property that's already existent and just, you know, really put a shine on it. And so he is one of the most powerful Hollywood filmmakers today, the very singular vision. He certainly has his shortfalls and his critics. I don't think he's you know, quite as beloved as say someone like a Steven Spielberg from a generation earlier. Seems to have less variety within his canon, but he is a force to be reckoned with. And Tenet, you know, I think shows his power and stature in Hollywood to be able to get this incredibly complicated film made, though it is probably going to diminish that to some degree just because it's had so many, it's just not a critical or box office success. So for some of which, for reasons beyond Christopher Nolan's control.
Well, before we get into talking specifically about his films and his worldview, I just want to ask, you know, just for the person listening that hasn't been as familiar with his films, why should Christians watch his films?
Well, I think, you know, Nolan is really a wonderful figure to interact with, an auteur, certainly someone who has a kind of a authorship that can run throughout his movies. So in interacting with Nolan's movies, you definitely sense the persona behind them. And so, you know, in the same way that we want to dialogue with people and understand where they're coming from in order to comprehend their ideas and then be able to speak to them, you know, Nolan has a kind of clarity that I think can be illuminating. He's also a filmmaker who has a sort of gentlemanly British politeness to his films overall. They can be dark and they sometimes deal with violence, but they tend to be a bit old fashioned in terms of their cleanness of language and other elements. And so I think he's a really good filmmaker to get into and think about. His movies are fun to watch, but then they're also fun to discuss, much in the way that I think Alfred Hitchcock has this quality, which is that, you know, Hitchcock's movies are entertaining, they're beautifully made kind of popcorn films, and then they also reward discussion and thinking about them. And so Nolan's a great kind of test case for people who want to sort of flex their critical skills.
So let's just get into some of his themes in his films. And so one of the key features that you talk about in your review about his films is that he uses chronology in storytelling. So why don't you unpack that for us?
Yeah, so there are a number of contemporary filmmakers who, you know, clearly play with time and tell stories in non-chronological orders. Quentin Tarantino is probably the other really notable, you know, contemporary filmmaker who really likes to play with time. But for Nolan, it's beyond just, you know, sort of a element of his filmmaking. It really seems to be an obsession. So Nolan's movies are often told in non-chronological order in order to amplify the suspense of the story or to bring out thematic elements more strongly. The most notable example of this is in his breakout movie Memento, which tells the story of a man who has had a brain injury, which causes him to have short-term memory loss, so he can't form new memories. So every so often, he just forgets where he is. He's covered his bodies with tattoos that will remind him of his condition. And in order to put the audience in the headspace of this main character, Nolan tells the story in an innovative, non-chronological way. He tells the story backwards. So we see a scene play out with the main character. His name is Leonard Shelby. And then we'll kind of have an interstitial scene. And then we cut back to his story. We're actually earlier chronologically in Leonard Shelby's day. So we are disoriented. Suddenly we go, where are we? And Leonard feels the same way. It's a very inventive storytelling technique, one that was suggested by Nolan's brother, who's been his co-writer quite often. But you see this non-chronological storytelling, lesser degree in Insomnia, but certainly in The Prestige and Interstellar a bit. But then in really major ways, in, for instance, Batman Begins, which cuts back and forth between Bruce Wayne's childhood, his life as a young man, and then his new burgeoning role as this Dark Knight protecting Gotham. And so Nolan is going to reorganize cinematic time for the viewer in order to really kind of highlight, especially, you know, themes that he wants to play with. And so we're, you know, in order to reserve some suspenseful element and piece of information in order to give it to us later on. Inception probably has some of the best use of Nolan's playfulness with time. And it famously, as they descend to the dream world, it's about a science fiction world where people can enter other people's dreams. And the further down in the dream world you go, the more time slows down. And so you have sort of three different concurrent timelines playing out with three different time speeds. And this is all used to great effect, very suspensefully. There's a similar thing in Dunkirk where you have three different stories taking place over three different times, a week, a day, and an hour. And so Nolan has caught on to something that you can do with cinema, which is to control the passage of time quite masterfully. And I think he does this better than any other living filmmaker.
You just started talking about him controlling the passage of time, and that's another interest that he has, the interest of time itself. So how does Christopher Nolan use time in his various films?
Well, of course, this is a pressing issue because of the movie that we're going to talk about a bit here, which is Tenet, his newest movie, which is a time travel film, though with a certain twist. And Nolan is going to, you know, play in all sorts of ways with time, but we'll talk about this later. But Nolan seems to use time in a couple different ways. So one is that he wants to suggest in certain ways that past is still present, right? That even though real world time has passed, that sort of events, you know, that have gone on a long time ago are often still feel quite close to us. So he uses it to collapse time so that things that happened a good bit of chronological distance are still happening sort of present in the mind of the main characters. He also seems to, you know, have a real fixation on the inevitable passage of time, which leads to our death and destruction. And so in one of his most successful uses of time in this recent film, Interstellar, he has a scene where the hero, Matthew McConaughey, Cooper in the film, has gone off on this interstellar voyage. And as a result of traveling much faster than people on Earth are traveling, so I don't know what percentage of light speed he's going, but he's going very quickly. And so as a result of Einsteinian relativity, time is passing more slowly for Cooper. And so after, you know, a period of travel, he gets all these video messages at once, and he sits down to watch them, and he proceeds to watch his children grow up before his very eyes, the children that he's left behind on Earth, because he has to go off and save Earth. And so it's become a meme. It's such a famous scene, Matthew McConaughey sitting in a chair and weeping over these videos. And that, to me, is important. I think that it's more than just a powerful emotional scene that relies upon a scientific premise. It really is getting at something that I think is deep in Nolan, which is a sense of the harshness of the universe, the way that we are often placed in situations where we have a kind of tragic conflict of goals, and we have to choose, you know, one thing that will cost us, you know, dearly somewhere else, and that time is really this sort of grim reaper that's coming for us all. Nolan doesn't seem to have a particularly sunny view of the universe. He seems to be, the universe is a fairly harsh and dark place, and so he often plays with time to intensify what is, in his view, a real experience for all of us, is that in the end, you know, all of us, you know, go into that good night, but he thinks that we should rage against this. And so he's always trying to kind of sharpen our perception of the harsh passage of time.
I think one of the other things that Christopher Nolan focuses on is memory in his films. You were just mentioning a few moments ago, Memento and also Interstellar. So one thing, you know, when you're describing Interstellar, it's like there's ways in which not only time, but memory plays a part in it. In other words, and I don't want to give any spoilers if anyone hasn't already seen Interstellar, but then again, it came out so long ago, so I don't know if we can prevent spoilers at this point. But
statute of limitations on spoilers.
Exactly. If a film's been out for quite some time, years, then I think we can talk about it. But, you know, when his daughter in this crucial scene, you know, where he's in this other dimension and then things are shown to him, which are memories of things that had happened. At the same time, his daughter is remembering those things as an adult to try to think of, well, how can this, you know, predicament that he's in be solved? And so it's interesting because he both uses, you know, chronology, time, and memory to cause us to think about various different ethical things. But so what is significant about his exploration of memory, both, you know, say in Memento as well as in Interstellar and his other films?
Well, of course, Memento has this question, you know, it's just that it's, what would life be like if you couldn't form new memories? So the main character, Leonard Shelby, played by Guy Pearce, has this condition where he's, you know, continually sort of waking up. The last thing he remembers is his wife's death, or so he thinks. And so he's constructed his life in such a way that he can remind himself, you know, what's going on. He has all this evidence of his wife, who killed his wife, tattooed on his body. And but his inability to form new memories, of course, prevents him from moving on from this tragic event. He's kind of trapped, as it were, in this moment continually. And, you know, Nolan is keenly aware that, you know, this is a very destructive and dangerous place to be, is to be unable to move on in a certain way. And so the film is, you know, it talks not only about the power of memory, you know, the power that forgetting can have over us. If we can't remember who we are, then we, you know, can't meaningfully interact with the world. And also, if we can't forget something or can't kind of balance out old memories with new ones, then we're going to have a lot of problems. We also see, especially I think in Batman Begins, his interest in memory. We see Bruce Wayne, you know, sort of frequently remembering his father, his father's death, his father's advice to him. And he's sort of caught between, you know, honoring his father's example and avenging his father's death. And so we have a key scene in Batman Begins where he goes, as a young man, he goes with the intention to shoot his father's killer outside a courthouse. And his childhood friend tells him that his father would be ashamed of him. And so he takes his gun and he throws it away and decides to try and discover another way to fight crime. And so, you know, in a Nolan movie, you know, the themes are amped up, you know, they're highly present. He's, you know, he really wants to sort of wring meaning from every, you know, kind of possible scene and moment. And all of his, you know, highfalutin, you know, concepts that he's going to use to tell his story or perform some grand spectacle are still really centered around important ideas and elements. And so you have, you know, for instance, in Inception, the main character. So there are all these, you know, dead parents, dead family members, that kind of thing. And in a Nolan movie, Inception, the main character, Dom Cobb, is continually sort of going back down into his own dreams to spend time with his departed wife. He's sort of kind of like Leonard Shelby. He's keeping himself from moving on by re-experiencing her as if she was alive. And so Nolan's got a kind of psychoanalytic perspective on the human person, right? Which is that we're powerfully shaped by, you know, our developmental forces and our history, and that we're replaying and having to sort of deal with our various kind of traumas, or probably we're positively influenced by our good experiences. And then he's going to add on top of it all sorts of complications. What if you know, actually can't form new memories and move on? What if you could continually go back and spend time with your departed wife? What would that do to you? What if you experience the growing old of your children all at once? He's going to use his high concept elements to play with and to reinforce these themes and these challenges that characters face.
I do think, as an aside, that some of that is linked to his idea of memory and love, whether it's the idea in Memento or he's saying in Interstellar about his daughter, even as an adult, I know she's going to get it right because she knows that I love her, even though they had been estranged for all this, you know, time passage, which is kind of you know, the odd way they do it in terms of earthly years being more than light years, that kind of thing. So it's really interesting how he thinks about some of those things.
Yeah, Interstellar does have this curious theme that's a little bit of an outlier in Nolan's filmography, which is this notion that there is almost some force in the universe which is intangible, and that force is love. You know, of course, the big sci-fi conceit of the film that basically enables father and daughter to reconnect is explained naturalistically in the concept of the movie, which is this idea that some future humans built a sort of construct by which people could communicate across time. But so the humans saved themselves. This is always the case in Nolan's movies, pretty much, is that it's just us. There's no sort of transcendent reality. But Interstellar does, you know, perhaps offer the faint glimmer of something transcendent, some force, the love force in the universe, which we can access mysteriously.
Yes, I do agree with you. I think that in the end, Nolan films seem to be very humanistic in that the saviors that we have, whatever they may be, whether it's, you know, these tattoos or it's what we're going to discuss shortly in Tenet or, you know, Interstellar, it's ourselves, it's humanity itself.
You're listening to the Postmodern Realities podcast from the Christian Research Institute and the Christian Research Journal. Today's guest is Dr. Philip Tallon, who has written an online exclusive film review for the Christian Research Journal, and it's called Time May Change Me, But I Can't Change Time, Reversing Time to Understand Christopher Nolan's Tenet. You can read it for free online at our website, equip.org. And at equip.org, you can subscribe to the Christian Research Journal. A subscription is $33.50. But we'd like you to help us get the word out about this podcast and partner with us. And the easiest way you can do that is just simply tell a friend. But even better yet, would you please give us a rating or review on any platform where you get this podcast, but most particularly Apple Podcasts. Search for Postmodern Realities, and you can easily leave us very quickly a starred review, or if you have a moment, please leave us a written review and tell other people why you enjoy listening to this content. In addition, if you don't have the funds right now in your budget for a full print subscription, please consider giving us a tip, like $3 or $5, a small amount. Everything would be helpful to us to help continue to bring you this free content, and do that by heading over to our website, equip.org. At that main page, you will see magazine. At the drop-down menu, you will find Postmodern Realities, and at any landing page, including the one for this one about Tenet, you will find the link where you can give us a tip. And thank you for all the ways that you get the word out about this podcast.
Well, I want to turn now to Tenet, which you have written a film review for us. As I mentioned, that's on our website. And Tenet is now out in various places. Although of this recording in early October, it's been announced that some of the big movie theater chains are closing down for maybe indefinitely until there's more films for them to have audiences, even at a reduced capacity. So some of the big tentpole films that were on track to be released this fall have been moved to 2021. So hopefully some of you, if you haven't seen Tenet, you can see it, but I'm sure you can see it in the next year, I'm hoping. But it was delayed many times. And so since then, it has been released. I think in Labor Day weekend it came out, although it didn't come out in mainly the big, huge markets, which is New York City and Los Angeles. It was not able to be there. So how is the film doing as of now before the, you know, theaters closing down indefinitely? And what has been its critical reception?
Well, it's certainly hampered by the coronavirus here in the United States. So it's not doing particularly well. I think it's under 50 million. And, you know, I went to go see it a few weeks ago when it first came out, and then I saw it again over the weekend. And both times the theater is almost empty, you know, that even with the social distancing measures, just almost no one is going to the theater. You know, we're in Houston, and I went to the, you know, big local, you know, multiplex, very nice. And, you know, I was in the movie about a half an hour, and I'm really thirsty, man, I wish I could go get a drink. And so I went out, and they were already shutting down the concession thing. I couldn't even get a cup of water in the theater because there are just so few people. It's not even worth manning the concession stand. So Tenet's not done terribly well in the U.S. It has done better overseas. You know, I think it should make its $200 million budget back. It looks like it's made about $300 million worldwide. But the critical reception has not been amazing. For one thing, it's an incredibly complex film. You know, most Nolan movies are, you know, fairly intricately constructed, but this one is downright confusing. You know, I took my 16-year-old daughter, she's watched through, you know, many movies with me, and she turned to me and she said, "I just have no idea what's going on." And I could not immediately explain to her what was happening, because there are, you know, there's a lot going on in this movie, and much of it is difficult to follow. And so I think this is a case where Nolan has, to some degree, you know, he's not underestimated the intelligence of the American public for the most part, which is to say that I think he's made smart movies, gambling that audiences want smart movies, and they have, and he's been rewarded for that. This one strikes me as being, you know, too clever for most audiences, and also, you know, not terribly enjoyable to watch, such that I didn't really relish the idea of going back and seeing it again a second time. It can be kind of a bleak and grim film without a lot of pleasure. So critical reception hasn't been great. Box office is overall down. So Nolan was not able to save Hollywood by getting people to rush back to the theaters. Tenet was not the movie to do that. And, you know, I doubt that this is going to affect him very much. I think they'll always be happy to have him come back and make a comic book movie or even an original concept. He's still got some credit for all that he's done. But the film is, what the film is about is it's set within a sort of gritty James Bondish world of, you know, government agents and supervillains. It's a globe-trotting movie whose central idea is that there is in the future a technology is developed which can reverse the entropy of objects or people, sending them moving backward in time. So, you know, you might imagine that you're experiencing your day sequentially, 8 a.m., 9 a.m., 10 a.m., and then at noon, you get into an entropy reversing machine, and then you would experience your day sequentially, but in reverse, 11 a.m., 10 a.m., 9 a.m., 8 a.m. And so you'd be moving backwards in time, sort of through the stream of your day as you had experienced it before. So this technology exists. People are sending objects back. And this enables the supervillain of the movie to be communicating with people in the future who are sending him gold and sending him technology and so forth by burying it in locations which he can then unearth in the past. The hero, an unnamed hero called just the protagonist in the credits, and he seems to kind of take this mantle on himself, is initiated into an organization known as Tenet. And the attentive reader anybody who's seen the previews and who's looked at the title would figure out that obviously Tenet is a palindrome. It reads the same backwards and forwards. It also has the word 10 in it. And it's connected to an ancient Roman object called the Sator Square, which we can talk about, which is full of palindromes. But it's about this character named the protagonist, played by John David Washington, in a sort of kind of swaggering James Bondish role. And he's initiated into this secretive organization and set loose to try and figure out what is going on with time reversal in order to stop a terrible apocalypse from happening. And most of the movie is pretty much a straightforward James Bondish quest to stop the supervillain and his evil plan. However, it is palindromic in that many sequences have characters moving in two directions in time at once, causing all sorts of, you know, strange and exciting features on screen, but they can also be quite confusing. So we experience a number of action scenes from both chronological directions. The central portion of the film basically flips, so we have the same scene where the characters are moving through it in two different directions. And then the final battle is a 10-minute sequence where two different groups of people are trying to carry out a mission, and they're moving in two directions in time. And it can be quite confusing to understand what's going on. So that's the basic setup. If that all of this excites you, the sound of, you know, all of this sort of time reversal and playfulness excites you, then Tenet is probably the movie for you. You probably also like playing board games and doing puzzles.
Well, I would say you talked about your 16-year-old going to see Tenet with you, and I took my 16-year-old to see Tenet with me. And it's interesting. There is, when you were talking about entropy, there is a bunch of physics that is in the film. So I think for science nerds, they might find it interesting. And so after my 16-year-old wanted to see it again, I don't know, there's no theater showing it near me when that will happen. But then he was saying that he had a AP physics test and he was trying to puzzle out something. And he said he just remembered how things work backwards in Tenet. And then he wrote that down and ended up being right. So Tenet, I guess, did help him with AP physics. So, you know, we don't even know if people can go see this film, but I think having seen it, that it's worth seeing in theaters, although just from the reviews, it is kind of a polarizing film. But where does Tenet sit within Nolan's filmography that we've talked about, you know, from Inception or Memento or Interstellar? They've always had these little twists. And of course, Tenet has another twist with it. So where would you rank that in his Batman movies, which is a little bit different because that was kind of the superhero type of genre, comic book hero come to life, although it was very dark and gritty. But where does this film sit within his kind of history of the various films that he's done?
Well, it does feel like a culmination in a lot of ways, which is, this is a filmmaker who is in, you know, command of action sequences, who has been able to puzzle out a very, you know, complicated story. I mean, just to the thought of trying to create an action scene where you have two different sets of people moving in two directions in time is the sort of thing that, you know, really only a genius could do, or someone with incredible, you know, patience and effort. So I think it shows that no one's still swinging for the fences, and he's still working really hard to do interesting things. It reminds me the most of Memento. And then I think that is a movie that is somewhat polarizing, which is, if you don't like really kind of complicated film techniques and someone who's not going to hold your hand and just sort of tell a story the way he wants it, then this movie will probably appeal to you. Most of his more recent work, I think, has been more popular. So Inception, Interstellar, Dark Knight, these movies go down pretty smooth. Tenet is more challenging, and it's a movie that I think will probably, you know, it's going to underwhelm. I think it will probably have a little bit of a longer shelf life, because I think there are a certain group of people who will want to come back to it and think about it and talk about it. And even reading up various pieces, it seems like Nolan's done a lot more that he's hidden within the film that will repay our attention. So, you know, the thing I mentioned earlier is the Sator Square. So this is an ancient Roman image of a series of words that are arranged in a square, and they contain words like opera and arepo and Sator and rotas, and tenet forms the central cross of the Sator Square. And in the film, you have characters named Sator and a shipping company named Rotas, and there's an opera scene, and then there's an art forger named Arepo. And so Nolan is kind of thinking about these things, burying them in this movie, but there are even more, you know, theories about the movie that people are beginning to discuss, which some of the theories I think are quite credible. So I think this is a movie that will, it's a cult classic pretending to be a blockbuster. Maybe that's the best way of putting it. And I think it will live on as an object of fascination, though, as one critic put it, is a movie that is easier to admire than to love. And it is not a warm film. There is very little emotion. The characters are, fairly kind of cold in their affect. Robert Pattinson probably delivers the most charming performance. And I think some fan theories give good reasons for explaining why this is. So I think this movie is going to have legs. I think all Nolan movies are going to continue to be watched for some time.
I think in the future, this movie will be probably more overall liked than it is maybe currently. And it's hard because not a lot of people have seen it as well, but there'll be a lot for people to just dissect in it over the years. And yeah. I don't think he was trying to do a character study in it. I think one of the criticisms were, well, we can't really care about any of these people. It just seems like an action film with no character development. But I'm not sure if he thought he could do a sequel with this film because it kind of leaves you hanging at the end where they could do something. But, you know, so do all of his other, not all of his other films, but for sure, you know, Inception, you know, it just leaves you hanging at the end and everyone goes, what happened? What is going on? You know, what's really real? And I don't know if he will or will not return to something that is a specifically original piece to him, like Tenet is, as opposed to, oh, we've contracted you for these Batman films.
I wouldn't put it past him to, you know, he seems to have a pretty deep well of ideas that he's, you know, coming back to, things he's been thinking about for a long time. And so, you know, he'd been talking about Inception for years and he had the idea for Dunkirk for years. And so, you know, I think that he's probably not going to run out of material anytime soon. I think really what audiences probably wish this was James Bond or something, right? Which is to say a kind of rollicking good time about a cool guy saving the world. And this movie is much more astringent and, you know, I don't know, serious in that it, you know, and it's really requiring a lot of work for us. I think the movie that, you know, we all want to see is Avengers Endgame or something where just, you know, we kind of all get to cheer and shout at the screen and feel like everything's okay. Whereas this movie is about averting, you know, an apocalypse, but not in a way that makes you feel like you've won particularly.
And you don't really know totally based on the film at the end, you know, what's really happening because of the chronology situation. But in your article, you talk about Nolan's worldview. And so what are Christopher Nolan's philosophical, I guess we'd say, obsessions? And how do you see his worldview in his filmography and specifically in Tenet?
Yeah, well, so Nolan is a very tight-lipped filmmaker. He doesn't talk about his own work very much. You know, and I think that's, you know, probably for the better. He's learned, you know, kind of, I think from magicians, he's interested in magicians, and he says, you know, a magician doesn't want to, you know, you don't want to tell your tricks. If you tell your tricks, then, you know, it'd be nothing to them. So he has, I think, that ethos. And so he doesn't really talk much about his own work, but he studied at King's College London. He studied philosophy and as well as filmmaking, and he clearly has some philosophical preoccupations. And one of the things that he keeps coming back to is this idea that in this world that we live in, as he sees it, you know, you often have to make a choice between you know, something that's ultimately reassuring and kind of a hard, brutal truth. You know, so there's a kind of conflict between the true, the good, and the beautiful, and that you can't have it all ultimately. So you have characters who, in order to have a meaningful life, they deceive themselves or they deceive others. You see this theme in The Dark Knight. You see this theme in Inception. You see this theme in Memento and in The Prestige and other places. And so he's very much fixated on this idea of kind of the noble lie, you know, like like Plato talks about in The Republic, and that, you know, people sort of need to be lied to in order to feel comforted. So there is a kind of a darkness to his worldview, but, you know, his characters sort of recognize this, and they're almost always tragic heroes who are kind of facing up against a brutal and different universe and who are making the hard choice in order to try and do what's right. Not always, but typically. And this, so it strikes me that Nolan has a sort of a nihilist with regard to the ultimate nature of the universe, or a naturalist. Just in the end, everyone will die, rot, be forgot. The universe will end in the heat death, and this, that'll be it. It's not a comforting place to be. But recognizing this, we have to, you know, we have to fight, right? Like Winston Churchill talks about at the end of Dunkirk, we have to, you know, with this resolve, we must fight for the good, even if ultimately we're going to lose. And so you see in the Dylan Thomas, you know, poem that tells us to rage against the dying of the light, we hear Michael Caine, who's, if there's a voice in a Christopher Nolan movie that's authoritative, it's Michael Caine. He always seems to know what the truth is. He reads that Dylan Thomas, you know, quote, rage, rage against the dying of the lights, you know, do not go gentle into that good night. And that's there's a tragic nobility that runs through Nolan's best films, I think. Though sometimes heroes stumble and fail. So I think Dom Cobb fails at the end of Inception. He sort of gives up on his quest for truth, leaving the top spinning, uncaring whether he's in the dream anymore. And Leonard Shelby fails at the end of Memento. He decides to delude himself in order to give himself a meaningful mission in life. That's a spoiler, but again, the movie's been out for 20 years. And so audiences who are interested in what filmmakers are, you know, want to say as authors, you should really be aware of this element in Nolan's work, because it's something that we can ingest without really thinking about it, and might come to share this view, you know, that in order to be happy or to have hope, we need to protect people from the truth. But a Christian believes that's not the case, right? We think that ultimately, you know, the true reality of the universe, reality itself, is beautiful and good and true and gives us hope, right? The core of everything is God. God is love.
So how would the Christian apologist, you know, approach Tenet's work and use it to have some discussions with people who are not religious?
Yeah, so it's a little bit hard not to spoil some things in Tenet, but there's a kind of an ethos that we find in expressed by the characters, you know, which is that they're living within a deterministic universe. So one thing that's really interesting about Nolan's account of time travel is that it's entirely deterministic, which is whatever has happened in the past is as locked in as whatever will happen in the future. And so though you can time travel, you can't change the past in some sense. If you move yourself back in time, you're just merely, that already has happened. So he has this kind of space-time unity view and very deterministic view. But his characters still, you know, want to take action, right? So one of the characters, Robert Pattinson's character, you know, says, even though he has this view that the mechanics of the universe are fated, he says, that's not an excuse for doing nothing. And I think you do hear this, you know, you hear this view from a lot of times naturalists or people who want to have an ethic that is, as it were, at odds with the ultimate nature of the universe, right? Which is that in the end, you know, our victories can only be short-lived and they'll never kind of echo into eternity if naturalism is true. And I think that people like Nietzsche have rightly seen that, you know, reality itself should kind of dictate, as it were, what our ethic is, rather than, you know, our sort of ideals of what the good would be, sort of allowing us to be deluded. And so it's not obvious that, you know, if in the end the universe is just going to doom us all to oblivion, why we should, you know, fight and sacrifice ourselves in the short run to help everyone else when we, in fact, you know, are ultimately going to experience the same fate. In the end, none of this will matter. So Nolan's got a kind of, I think, a narrative and a cinematic, you know, nobility he's going to present for ethics. But, it's hard to see why this is, really compelling for, you know, for those of us who face the hard choices. I think we admire it when it's on screen. We have the intuition that we should fight for the good, even if it is a great risk to ourselves. But if you are a thoroughgoing naturalist, it's hard to see kind of why this is anything other than just a personal whim or a warm desire that we get from watching heroic movies. I think we want our ideas to be, and our ethics to be, based in something deeper and more substantial.
Well, finally, I want to end on a lighter note, and I have some fun rapid-fire questions for Phil. So, Phil, dessert every night or only on special occasions?
Well, I wish I could say it was only on special occasions, but it's basically every night up at the Talent House.
And books or movies?
Well, it's a very painful choice. I suppose, I mean, I've read a lot of books. I think if it's about which, you know, what I'm watching, whether I'm watching more or reading more these days, I'm still reading more, though I kind of wish that I were watching more, because I do need to do some more research for my my book on horror movies that'll be coming out soon. So it's just gotta be both for me. Cause I like movies. I like books, and I write books based on movies.
Cups in your kitchen cabinets. Are they right side up or upside down?
They are right side up, stacked inside one another.
And does your family decorate your home for fall and the holidays? Are you getting out decorations for your house?
We do. The children did it this year because we're quite busy. My wife is a teacher and I'm a teacher, and my wife is having to build so many things online because we're still virtual. And so the children just took autumn leaves, which we don't have much up here in Houston, and just sort of taped them up to the various walls and hung up some streamers and things.
Well, thanks, Phil, for being a guest on the Postmodern Realities podcast.
Oh, my pleasure.
You've been listening to the Postmodern Realities podcast from the Christian Research Institute and the Christian Research Journal. Today's guest has been Dr. Philip Tallon, who has written an online exclusive film review for the Christian Research Journal, and his review is called "Time May Change Me, But I Can't Change Time: Reversing Time to Understand Christopher Nolan's Tenet." And you can read the review for free online at our website, equip.org. We'd like to hear from you, so connect with us on social media. Like the Bible Answer Man Facebook page and follow CRI, Christian Research Journal, Hank Hanegraaff, and the Bible Answer Man on Twitter. And please subscribe to the Bible Answer Man channel on YouTube. If you like this episode, please subscribe to the Postmodern Realities podcast on iTunes, and please rate and review our podcast. When you rate and review our podcast, it helps others see our content. And please share this episode on your social media accounts. Be sure you tune in daily to the Bible Answer Man broadcast, hosted by CRI President Hank Hanegraaff, who answers your questions live on air. To ask Hank a question, call 888-ASK-HANK, Monday through Friday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. In addition, head to iTunes and subscribe to Hank Unplugged, Hank's audio podcast. Follow Hank off the grid, where he has in-depth conversations with some of the brightest minds discussing topics you care about. So until our next Christian Research Journal author conversation, thanks for listening to the Postmodern Realities podcast.